You have the suspect's fingerprints at the crime scene. You have witnesses testifying that they saw the suspect commit the crime. The suspect has a motive. It's an open and shut case. Or is it? Each week, the Parcast original Not Guilty examines controversial criminal cases and tries to determine why solid evidence doesn't always lead to a conviction. What police considered compelling evidence against Casey Anthony in the disappearance of her daughter, Kaylee, defense attorneys classified as fantasy forensics, and she was ultimately acquitted of Kaylee's murder. And sometimes, jurors are responsible for wrongful convictions, as was the case when the Central Park Five were convicted, despite DNA evidence showing none of the suspects were involved. Search for and subscribe to Not Guilty wherever you listen to podcasts. Again, search Not Guilty or visit parcast.com/notguilty to listen now. On November 23rd, 2015, an envelope arrived at the Onondaga County Medical Examiner's Office in Utica, New York. The envelope was addressed to the coroner, and next to that, it read, "Regarding Mary Yoder." Inside the envelope was a typed 2-page letter. It was unsigned, but referenced the death of 60-year-old Mary Yoder, a woman who had mysteriously died just months earlier, in July 2015. Dr. Kenneth Clark had performed the autopsy, and after months of conducting numerous tests, had finally been able to conclude that the cause of Mary's death was colchicine toxicity. The anonymous letter seemed to be arriving at a nearly ideal time. Dr. Clark had been working with Mary's family, and more recently, with law enforcement, to try and figure out how exactly Mary had ingested the toxin, whether she had accidentally ingested it through supplements, or whether it was something more sinister. The letter read, in part, "Please forward to acting investigators. I know police are currently looking into this death, but I don't know where to send this information. This is in regards to the July 22, 2015 death of Mary Yoder in Utica, New York. If the toxin found in her was colchicine, Adam Yoder, her son, is responsible. He told me he did, and moreover, he told me how and where he put the rest of the toxin. When I saw him a couple of days ago, he appeared agitated, and he said he was the reason for her death, and he wished he could take it back. Then he said he got a bottle of colchicine off online and put the toxin in one of her vitamins when he was over at his parents' house. He said his mom noticed he seemed disturbed at the time, and she thought it was since he was drinking at her house. Adam said he told her no, the beer was not the reason he was disturbed, and to drop it. He said he apologized to his parents for ruining the holiday Father's Day and left. Adam was upset more people weren't paying attention to him. He felt he deserved more attention and thought people would be nicer to him. He acted resentful and belligerent to his family and became visibly irritated people kept talking about his mom. He says he expected a financial payout after her death, which did not come. After he found out he was not getting the money he thought he would, he said he regretted what he did, was hysterical, and he didn't know what he was going to do, but he had ideas. He said now the colchicine container is under the front seat, passenger side of his Jeep. That's where he said it was until he figures out where to dispose of it or put it next. I asked him to show me where he kept it currently, and he said no, but described it as a small glass bottle. I am sending this anonymously because I can't keep this information. It is right to alert authorities, but it's hard to do. It's still hard to do, and I fear attaching my name to this information right now. I am very close to him, but what he did was wrong, and I believe he would be capable of repeating this act. Adam's monetary concerns are suspect because he has struggled financially and supported somewhat by his parents' assistance. Colchicine is a very specific name, and the name of the toxin found in Mary Yoder is not released. So if they were one and the same, it is not a coincidence. After he related this to me, the information about where the specific toxin is and the details, I feel this is necessary for appropriate authorities to pursue this. The letter writer goes on to give Adam's current address, along with the make and model of his Jeep. For weeks, investigators had been focused on Mary's husband, Bill, as their main suspect in her death. But this letter gave them new leads to follow in a different direction, focusing now on Mary's son. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 72. Bill and Mary Yoder had been married for 37 years at the time of her death and had three grown children, Leanna, Tamarin, and Adam. They had gone to chiropractic school together and eventually opened up their own office together, Chiropractic Family Care, in Whitesboro, New York, in 1987. By all accounts, Bill and Mary were happily married, and they were about to take a month-long vacation to Europe in the fall of 2015. But on July 21st, 2015, with Bill by her side, Mary Yoder went to the emergency room at St. Luke's Hospital near their house in Utica, New York. Mary told the doctors that she was experiencing extreme abdominal pain, nausea, and diarrhea. Doctors ran numerous tests on her, but they couldn't seem to find a definitive answer as to what was going on. Mary was admitted to the hospital for observation. Bill decided to leave Mary at the hospital for the night, and he got home around 9 p.m. He went to sleep, but was awakened at about 5 a.m. to two police officers knocking on his front door. They told him that his wife's condition had taken a turn for the worse. Her condition was bleak and was rapidly declining. Bill went to the hospital, and pretty soon, all three of his kids were there too. Mary wasn't getting any better, and in fact, she just kept getting worse and worse. Mary passed away later that afternoon, and months later, it was determined that somehow she had what's known as colchicine in her system. Colchicine, in its natural form, is found in a flower known as the autumn crocus. It's a toxin that's used to treat gout in controlled and precisely dosed amounts, but if too much is ingested, it can be deadly. Investigators set their sights on Bill almost immediately once they began investigating the case. Through interviews with Bill and Mary's three adult children, they learned that in November, Bill had told them that he was in a new relationship, just 4 months after the death of his wife. Even more interesting to the investigators, however, was who Bill's new girlfriend was, Mary's sister, Kathy. They confiscated Bill's phone and computers, as well as the computers and electronics from the chiropractic office, but they were unable to find anything that could connect him to the purchase of any colchicine. After he received the anonymous letter, Dr. Clark handed it over to investigators. And later that same day, investigators discovered that they too had received an anonymous letter, whose content looked exactly the same as the other one. Both letters accused Adam Yoder of having killed his own mother. Investigator Mark Van Namme called Adam and asked him to come into the station. When he arrived, they took him back to an interrogation room. They told him they had received an anonymous letter, a letter that implicated him, and asked if they could search his car. Adam looked nervous and asked if he could talk to a lawyer, but after speaking with an attorney, he agreed. When the officers searched Adam's car, they went right to the front passenger seat, right where the anonymous letter writer had said the poison would be. And sure enough, there it was. A small cardboard container with an even smaller vial inside, tucked underneath the seat. Written on the container, in large letters, was the word colchicine. Investigators took Adam back into the interrogation room and interviewed him some more. Next to the cardboard box with the vial inside was the receipt for the purchase. It had been purchased on January 5th, 2015, from a company called artchemicals.com. The name of the purchaser on the receipt was Adam Yoder, with a contact email of MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com. Adam told them that he had never heard of artchemicals.com before, and that although the email address was similar to ones he did have, this one was definitely not his. Before letting him leave the station, investigators took a buccal swab so they could compare Adam's DNA with any evidence they came across. Adam consented. A few days later, on December 21st, Adam's on-again, off-again girlfriend, 23-year-old Caitlin Conley, came into the Oneida County Sheriff's Office to speak with detectives. This would be her second interview since the investigation into Mary's death began. Caitlin and Adam were both college students at SUNY Polytechnic Institute. They met at Caitlin's high school graduation party back in 2011 and started dating shortly after. They then went through a couple breakups and a couple makeups before finally calling it quits in 2014. But even though they were no longer dating, they still remained in each other's lives. And in fact, when Mary died, in her obituary, Caitlin was listed as a loved one. In a Facebook post she wrote just a day after Mary's death, Caitlin wrote, "Dr. Mary, I still can't believe you're gone. Yesterday was so sudden. You truly were a positive light in the world, and I'm so lucky and thankful our lives crossed paths. There wasn't a day I didn't look forward to work with you. You taught me so much and had such a profound impact on my life." Investigators wanted to speak with Caitlin, who often went by Katie, so they could get more details on the layout of the Yoder's chiropractic office, as well as learn more about how the business was run. Katie had been working the front desk as the receptionist slash office manager for the last few years, since 2012, and had been working the day Mary initially fell ill. Katie told investigator Van Namme that she arrived at work at about 7:30 on the morning of July 20th, 2015. She said Mary, whom she called Dr. Mary, arrived somewhere a little after 8 a.m. that day. Dr. Mary saw patients all morning, and then at 12:30, she left for lunch, before coming back around 1:30. She said Dr. Mary had told her that she went to her mom's house for lunch, but that her mom had already eaten. So she came back and ate, which Katie said she assumed was Dr. Mary's usual lunch, a shake made from powder she typically brought from home and almond milk. Katie said it was a typical day, up until about 4:30 p.m., when Dr. Mary said she didn't feel well. She told Katie that her stomach was bothering her, and then she proceeded to go to the bathroom a couple times, which Katie said was out of the ordinary. She told investigators that Dr. Mary left the office around 6 p.m. after her last patient had left. Shortly after leaving, Dr. Mary called Katie and asked her to water the plants at the office. She told her that she had never felt so sick and just needed to get home. While investigator Van Namme was interviewing her, Lieutenant Robert Nelson came in. He asked her if she was aware of what Mary had died from, and she said all she knew was that it was a toxin, but didn't know the name of it. Lieutenant Nelson told her that it was colchicine, and she said she had never heard of that word before. He wrote it down on a piece of paper and slid it across the table towards her. She looked down at it and said, "Huh, I've never seen that before." Investigator Van Namme asked Katie what Bill's demeanor was like the last few months after he returned to the office after Mary's death. She said Bill seemed kind of uninterested in the case, that if the subject of the case came up with the patient, he would just tell them to cooperate and answer any questions the detectives had. Investigator Van Namme then started asking questions about Katie's relationship with Adam. He noticed that her demeanor immediately began to change. She started looking down, looking at her fingernails, and even started to cry. She said she last saw Adam about 3 months ago, on September 21st, 2015. He had asked her to go to the chiropractic office with him so he could collect any supplements that were there in an effort to help find what his mother could have ingested. She let him in with her key, and then she said Adam was acting suspect, that he started looking around frantically, looking through books and appointment books on the counter. She said they had a disagreement about him being there. She also recalled that sometime earlier in the year, in February, a package was delivered to the office addressed to Adam. She said he came by and picked it up. She never opened it and didn't know what was in it. She also said she was worried because sometime over the summer, she remembered seeing a spilled bottle of what said Colacol near the back office. Powder had leaked out of it, which she said was unusual because that's not what Colocol looks like. It's usually in pill form. She said she scooped it back into the vial, closed it, and put it back into the cardboard sleeve it had been in. She was worried that if that had been the toxin, her DNA would be on it. Investigator Van Namme then asked her about the MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com email address and asked if that was Adam's. Katie told him that she had never seen that email address before, that she only knew of one that had his initials and birthday in it. He told her that they had been able to trace one of the IP addresses associated with that Gmail account back to, oddly enough, her parents' house. He asked if that's the case, who would be logging into that? Katie told him that Adam would have had to have done it. Investigator Van Namme would later say that at this point, a light bulb went off in his head. The anonymous letter writer had specifically pointed a finger at Adam, and now here Katie was, talking about Adam's suspect behavior. He decided to ask her directly, "Katie, back in November, did you write us an anonymous letter?" Katie started crying and shaking. "I'm so scared. You can't protect me," she told him. He told her she might be their only witness, and that if she did write the letter, he needs to know. Katie said yes, she was the anonymous letter writer. He thanked her for being honest with him, and then left the room to confer with his fellow officers. They then told him that another piece of evidence had just come in, and what he learned next was something that could lead them in yet another direction. Another one of the IP addresses associated with the email address that had purchased the Colchicine, MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com, was identified as the IP address of Katie's own cell phone. Investigator Van Namme now had a lot more questions he wanted to ask her. Katie had gone from being a witness to now being a possible suspect herself. Investigator Van Namme went back into the interrogation room. This time, he made sure the video and audio recorders were on. And this time, he read her her rights.
"Did you understand everything I read to you? Okay. Now that I've advised you your rights, are you willing to answer my questions without an attorney? Are you willing to keep talking to me without an attorney?
No.
Okay. Okay. I really appreciate you helping us out and pointing us in the right direction with the letter. Into Adam, okay? You follow me then?
Yeah.
Okay. Why are you so upset? Have I been anything less than nice to you?
I've been really nice. I'm right. Adam's really smart.
Okay. And you've said that to me a couple times, that Adam's really smart. And he's not going to let anything come back to him. I understand that. But myself and my friends in the other room, the investigators on this case, are really good at what we do, okay? And we always get to the truth, okay?"
Katie told Investigator Van Namme that Adam told her everything in September while they were at the office. She said he told her he had put the Colchicine in with Dr. Mary's vitamins and supplements, but she wasn't sure which ones. He told her he regretted what he had done. "But does he regret it because of what he did? Or because he told me?" she asked. She said she tried to talk to him more about it, but he refused. Investigator Van Namme asked Katie if Adam had told her how he had gotten the Colchicine, and she said he bought it and then had it shipped to the office. He then asked her if she had ever logged into that email account before, and she now said yes, that she had seen it on her phone, and so she deleted it. She said she knows it was logged into from other places because she saw Adam logging into it. She said she even saw him logging into it in the office during business hours. And he could have been the one logging into it from her parents' house, too. Investigator Van Namme pulled out a printed list of all the logins for that email address and asked what she would say if he told her that Adam had been out of town during some of the logins that were coming back to the office and to her parents' house. She said she thinks he could have logged in remotely, making it look like it was coming from the office. Investigator Van Namme told her that wasn't possible, that it would show up on his report, and then she said that it could have been her. "I'm so scared," she said. "Why are you scared?" Van Namme asked. You know why, she replied.
I know why. I know why. Why are you scared?
You don't think I should be scared of him? You don't think so?
As long as you're telling me the truth, no. But I need honest answers.
At one point, Katie began crying and said she was afraid that Adam put it back on her and was trying to make it look like she was the one who purchased the colchicine. She said he told her at the office that if anyone was going to get into trouble for this, it was going to be her. She said he had told her that she was connected to everything. Van Namme then asked if someone else could have killed Mary. She said if that was the case, then Adam had to have known who it was, since he knew about the colchicine. He questioned why Adam would hold on to the colchicine, why he wouldn't have just discarded it after using it to get rid of the evidence. She surmised that maybe he was saving it to use on somebody else again, and he said, what if I told you that there wasn't enough in the bottle to use again?
I'm going to ask you a straight-up question. Every time I ask these, I already know the answer. Is it possible that somebody made it look like Adam did this?
Yes, but I don't think so.
It is possible that somebody planted that on him, because I can tell you right now, in the FBI's studies and everything that we went back on, guys don't hang on to the murder weapon because that's why they get caught.
Katie's response to that was, right, but guys also don't use poison. They say it's a lady's weapon. They say it's a lady's weapon, he repeated. They then discussed an incident that had happened between Katie and Adam in 2014. In November of that year, Katie called the police and told them that 4 months prior, Adam, who was her ex-boyfriend at the time, had physically and sexually assaulted her after a day of drinking. But about 2 weeks later, she said she no longer wanted to press charges and asked that no further action be taken against him. Investigator Van Namme asked her who knew about what happened, and she said Adam's mother did. She said she and Mary talked about it, and Mary told her that she believed her and would get her help if she needed it. Investigator Van Namme then went back to the discrepancies in her statement about the Gmail account.
See, I don't understand why, originally, you told me never seen that account before, right? That's how we started out. You didn't see it when I first wrote it down. You told me, I don't recognize it, haven't seen it.
Right.
Okay. Then a little while later, I deleted it. It's on my phone, obviously, I deleted it. Then a little while later, I've never been on it before, but I deleted it, so I had to have a password. Didn't want to tell me the password. Then my phone may be all over it. Why are we distancing ourselves from that Gmail account? Why not just say, I have a Hotmail account. If you ask me, hey, Mark, is this your Hotmail account? Yeah, that's mine. I use it all the time.
That's not mine.
That's not my Hotmail account. That's my wife's Hotmail account. And I've seen it all the time. You ever been on it? Yeah. I want to see who she's emailing. Why weren't you honest with me about that right off the bat?
She said it's another thing that connects her. Connects you to what? He asked her. It's just a Gmail account. She said it connects her to Adam, to everything, to the office. Everything connects me to the office and to Adam and to her, she said. He asked when she first heard about colchicine, and she said Adam first mentioned it to her about a year ago. She wasn't sure exactly how it had come up, but he asked her if she had ever heard about it and if she knew how to get some, and she said no. Katie was interviewed again 2 months later, in February 2016, this time by Lieutenant Robert Nelson. By this time, investigators had uncovered more evidence that made it look an awful lot like Katie was involved. For one thing, they learned that there were 2 prepaid credit cards that had been used to try to purchase the colchicine. For the first card, the order didn't go through, but the second card, the order did go through. Although Katie admitted to purchasing the prepaid credit cards, she refuted their accusation that she had purchased the colchicine.
Who took the credit card then? You were trying to tell me. We know what that credit card was trying to be used for.
Right, but I'm telling you it wasn't me.
Okay, so it's either you did this alone or someone else is involved with you because you got the credit cards.
Right.
Is Adam involved in this with you?
It's not with me. I'm not in this.
You bought the two cards.
I did.
Okay.
She said Adam had to have stolen the cards from her. She also said Adam had access to her phone after investigators told her they had found incriminating evidence on it after they confiscated it from her. But Lieutenant Nelson didn't believe her. He told her they only needed the why at this point.
Why, Katie? I guess that's it. Why? Was it accidental? Did Mary do something to you? Were you mad at Mary? Or was somebody else mad at Mary and they wanted you to help them? I don't know. Was it for the insurance money? Did you think if something happened to her, Adam would get money? Or are you that maybe angry or pissed off at Adam and hated Adam that much to where you wanted to get revenge on Adam? To get even with Adam? I don't know. You need to tell us that part. That's the part we need to know at this point.
Katie told him, I have a good life. I have people who love me. I want to be a mom someday. I wouldn't risk my life for this. You still can do all of that, but you made a mistake. Why? He asked. He told her he can help her. You can't help me, she said. She said she wants to finish college, wants to get married. She has a family who loves her, and she kept insisting she wouldn't do this. And then she started sobbing.
It's not a question anymore of who, Katie. It's why. God, please, just tell me why, Katie, that we can help you. It's the only thing left.
My life is over.
Life's not over, Katie. You're young. Your life is not over. You just need to know why. What drove you to this? What drove you to do this, Katie? Was it Adam?
No, I go to jail. I'll go to jail forever.
No, you will not, Katie. You won't go to jail forever. There's reasons for everything.
Katie started dry heaving into the garbage can Lieutenant Nelson moved over for her. Take some deep breaths. Take a sip of water. Why, Katie, it's over. What drove you to do this? But even so, Katie still maintained her innocence. Katie walked out of that interview that day, but 4 months later, on June 14th, 2016, she was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. She was also charged with forgery for signing Bill Yoder's name on a parking ticket and with larceny for stealing more than $90 from the chiropractic business. According to the indictment, prosecutors were contending that Katie purchased the colchicine from a company called Art Chemicals with a falsified letter and W-9 tax form. She then poisoned Mary before trying to frame Adam for it. In July 2016, Katie was offered a plea deal. She would plead guilty to second-degree murder in exchange for 17 years to life in prison. She rejected the deal, and so in April of 2017, Katie's trial began. She was facing 25 years to life in prison if convicted. Prosecutor Lori Lisi told the jury that all the evidence in the case points to Katie, even though she tried to frame Adam. She said the evidence will show that she was the one who set up the Gmail account and then ordered the colchicine from it. She also said that after Mary's death, Katie stole money from Bill. At Bill Yoder's lowest point, Caitlin Conley chooses to steal money from him, she said. The defense argued in their opening statements that it wasn't Katie who murdered Mary at all. It was Mary's husband, Bill. Katie lost a good friend when Mary died, and she didn't have any real reason to kill her. But Bill did, Katie's attorney, Christopher Pelly, said. He said Bill wanted to continue his relationship with Mary's sister, Kathy, a relationship that he said had been going on for about 6 months when Mary died. He also said Bill wanted to retire, which was another motive for wanting Mary dead. The state's first witness was Dr. Lingappa Amarnath, the ER director at St. Luke's Hospital. He testified that he first saw Mary at 9:56 in the morning in one of the hospital rooms. He said her complaints were nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal pain. Symptoms, he said, they see on a regular basis. Mary told him that her symptoms had started about 16 hours prior in the afternoon. He ordered complete blood tests, did a CT scan of her abdomen and pelvis, took stool cultures, and ordered an ultrasound of her gallbladder. He said her white blood cell count was elevated slightly, and her hemoglobin was slightly elevated as well. Her liver function test was also abnormal. Because of her elevated levels, they admitted her. They couldn't figure out what exactly was going on with her, and she needed more fluids and more treatment. Dr. Maria Gesualdo testified that she was the intensive care physician on call that night and that she received a call in the middle of the night. Mary had gone to use the bathroom and had an acute event where she had collapsed. Her blood pressure was low, and she was suddenly very hypoxic, meaning that she required a lot of oxygen. She pulled up Mary's file and reviewed all of her labs. She said she was concerned because Mary was relatively young and was healthy otherwise. She thought that most likely Mary had suffered some sort of infection, and so she ordered more tests. She arrived at the hospital a little while later, but right before she arrived, Mary had a cardiac arrest and had to be resuscitated. Her condition was even worse. Shortly thereafter, Mary's husband, Bill, arrived. When asked to describe Mary's declining condition, she said she was pretty much as sick as you could get. She said Mary coded at least 6 or 7 times, and they kept having to resuscitate her. And finally, a little after 2 in the afternoon, she coded for the last time. Dr. Kenneth Clark, the medical examiner who performed Mary's autopsy, walked the jury through the number of tests he did on Mary's body after receiving it. They finally determined that it was a toxin. They just had to figure out which one. After consulting with the Poison Control Center, they tested for colchicine, not something they test for very often. The test came back positive, and they were able to determine that it had been ingested orally. Dr. Clark told the jury that colchicine can be acquired at a pharmacy or in plants. He said there have been reports of people eating plant bulbs they think is raw garlic, but that it's actually colchicine, which can be fatal. He said he understood that Mary was taking a lot of herbal supplements at the time of her death, and because some of them aren't FDA regulated, he figured it could have been from one of those. He spoke with Mary's daughter, Leanna, who is also a doctor, and enlisted her family's help in rounding up all of Mary's vitamins and supplements. Mary and Bill's eldest daughter, Leanna, testified next. She told the court that she's a family practice physician and that in July of 2015, she was living in Long Island with her husband and 4 kids. Her parents lived in Sequoia, and her brother Adam was living with friends in Oneida. Adam was currently in school. He had finished a semester in May and was due to go back in the fall. He wasn't working that summer, and so she saw him several times. One of those times, he came and stayed with them in mid-July for her daughter's birthday. He arrived on July 15th, but he ended up leaving earlier than planned on July 21st, once their mom became sick. She described how her father called her on July 21st at about 9 a.m. He told her that her mom had come home the night before and had been throwing up and had vomiting and diarrhea. He asked her if she thought she needed a further evaluation. She had been sick for a good portion of the night and hadn't even come upstairs to their bedroom. He was concerned because she was moaning and looked very tired and just wanted to rest. Should he bring her to the hospital? He asked. She recommended they go to the emergency room, and so they did. She and her dad were in communication throughout that day, mostly by text message. He gave her and Adam, who was still staying with her, updates on how Mary was doing. Around 4 p.m., she learned that her mom had been admitted to the hospital, and she told her brother. He left her house later that night. When her dad called her early the next morning to tell her that her mom's condition had worsened, she immediately got in the car and made the 5 to 6 hour drive to St. Luke's Hospital. She said her father and Adam were both in shock when she arrived. Mary had arrested again, and everything was failing. At 2:54 p.m., her mother passed away. Mary was cremated on July 27th, which was what she wanted, Leanna said. In September 2015, she spoke with Dr. Clark, who told her that Mary had colchicine in her system. Dr. Clark asked her to look into how she may have gotten it. Leanna said her father and brother gathered all of Mary's medications and vitamins for her, and then her father brought them to the medical examiner. Her brother brought a container of opened almond milk that had been found at the office. She said her mom would often use almond milk in her shakes. Leanna said the fact that Mary was a gardener was also a concern to Dr. Clark. A week after Mary's death, the family gathered at Leanna's house in Long Island. At that point, they had received the results that there might be some sort of toxin that had gotten into Mary's system. The family, including Katie, were discussing if Mary had either eaten or drank anything abnormal that day. Then on September 24th, Katie texted Leanna and asked her if she could tell her more information about the toxin that was found. She asked if they suspected foul play or if the medical examiner's office thought that it had come from the office. Leanna told her that at this point they were running additional tests and that she didn't have more details. Leanna again asked her if Mary drank or ate anything different that day. Katie told her that Mary had gone to Leanna's grandmother's house and ate a sandwich there. Then she had come back and had her shake and vitamins. Leanna said they held a celebration of life gathering for Mary on July 25th. She said about 150 to 200 people came. Her dad was so upset he barely even made it there. She remembered telling him at one point to talk to her Aunt Kathy, Mary's sister, about it, because Kathy had lost a spouse too. Afterwards, they all went to Long Island, her brother and Katie included. Katie was there for about a week, and then Adam and her dad went to California to visit her dad's side of the family. Leanna told the jury that in November, her dad asked to meet with all the kids to discuss something with them. That's when he told them he was dating Kathy, Mary's sister. He said they had been leaning on each other for comfort, and then all of a sudden, in later September, their friendship turned into something more. Leanna told the court that her dad and Kathy are still together today. On December 4th, Leanna met with investigators. They told her that they were looking into her mom's death as a homicide. They asked her not to speak with any of her other family members about it. Then, on December 8th, Adam came to stay with her. He, too, had been speaking to investigators. He stayed with her through the following August, 2016. One by one, patients of Bill and Mary's chiropractic family care took the stand and testified about what they witnessed on the day Mary first became ill, on July 20th, 2015. The majority of them had appointments either early in the morning or early to mid-afternoon, and they all said that Mary was acting normally. But Lorraine Kramer testified that as she was waiting in her car for her ride after her appointment had ended, she saw Mary leaving. When asked if she made any observations of Mary during that time, she said yes. Quote, she didn't look good. Lucienne Gold also saw Mary later in the day, around 5:15. She said Mary was obviously different. She didn't seem like herself and didn't look like herself either. She was very pale and didn't have the big smile on her face as she normally did. Quote, it was very apparent that she was not well or something was wrong. We'll get into more testimony, including testimony from both Bill and Adam Yoder, right after this quick break from today's sponsor. Effective, natural skincare products, without harsh chemicals and sketchy ingredients, are essential. With Procure, you can feel better about feeling better. Procure makes guilt-free formulas that really work and that you can trust. Their products are powered by science and enriched with nature. They only use ingredients that heal, from proven remedies and natural botanicals. Procure has cleaned up their products. That means no parabens, alcohol, petrolatum, or fragrance. Procure's hydrocortisone cream with calendula is fast-acting, healing itchy, irritated skin with maximum strength 1% cortisone. It's enhanced with organic calendula extracts, a natural botanical that has been used for centuries to reduce inflammation. It gives you all the medicine you need, plus skin-loving ingredients like organic coconut oil. I'm one of those unlucky few whose skin sometimes gets a little irritated after wearing certain jewelry. I tried Procure with calendula and immediately noticed a difference. It goes on smooth, doesn't leave an oily residue, and it doesn't have that funky smell that other treatments have. Try Procure Hydrocortisone Cream with Calendula and get a special $3 discount on Amazon using the code 3JUNKIE. Just go to procureheals.com/junkie to be directed to Amazon, where you'll get a special $3 discount with the code 3JUNKIE. That's the number 3JUNKIE, all one word, and make sure you type it in caps. procureheals.com/junkie, code 3JUNKIE. Bill Yoder, now 71 years old, took the stand next. He said he first met Katie as Adam's on-again, off-again girlfriend. At the time, Adam was working at Chiropractic Family Care as the receptionist slash office manager. When he left to go to school, Katie then took over the position. Bill said that in 2015, the practice was open on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Mary worked all day on Mondays, and then they would split Wednesdays and Fridays. Katie would be there all day on each of the days and would sometimes even come in on the off days if there was a lot of work to do. When asked to describe his marriage, Bill said, quote, "It was wonderful. I mean, it was better than it had ever been. It just seemed to be getting better every day. We would really just loved being together." He said they had been talking about closing the business and retiring, but that they hadn't gotten around to doing it yet. In the summer of 2015, they were planning on going to Europe for a month. He said it was the first time they would be doing something like that. They had found a chiropractor in Syracuse who said he'd come in once a week and cover for them during that month. They had already made their plane reservations and a lot of the hotel reservations too. Bill was asked if Adam ever came in and used the two computers at the office. He said no, that Adam had his own laptop, which was a lot newer and better than theirs. One computer was at the front desk. That's the one that Katie worked on all the time and used to log patients in and out. The other was in the back office. He said he would use that one for tax work and things like that. On July 20th, 2015, the day Mary became ill, he said he woke up, exercised, showered, and kissed her goodbye as she left for the office around 7:45. He said he doesn't recall her eating anything that morning and that he doubts she did because she was usually in a rush. He doesn't recall talking to Mary at all during the day that day. He said he didn't go into the office, that he almost never goes in on Mondays. Mary would typically call him when she was on the way home so he would know to get dinner ready. She called him that day as she was leaving. Quote, "She didn't sound very good. She said she'd been very, very sick that afternoon, and she just had to come home right away. She couldn't talk, but she just had to come home." He said she got home around 6:45 or 7. The first thing she did when she walked into the house was to run to the bathroom. She was in there for a long time, he said. At some point, she came out. She was pale and sweating and just looked thoroughly drained. She told him that she had been vomiting, had diarrhea, and abdominal pain. He said she was in and out of the bathroom constantly. That night, she stayed downstairs on the couch, and he went upstairs to bed. When he woke up the next morning, he went downstairs, and he asked her if she had been able to sleep and how she was feeling. He said she looked worse than the night before, pale and sweating, just very exhausted and drained. He called their daughter, Leanna, and asked for her advice. They then decided to go to the emergency room. Mary asked him to run her a bath so she could clean up. But after he got the bath ready, she said she couldn't even do that, that she had to go right away. They got to the ER at about 9:30 or 10 that morning. After Mary was admitted to the hospital, he said the doctors told him that her tests were negative so far, and that there was really no reason to be worried, that it was just some kind of routine GI bug. He said he offered to stay there with her, but she told him that she just wanted to go to sleep and that he should go home. At that point, he thought he was going to have to cover all of her appointments the next day. When he got home, he went right to bed. His plan for the next day was to go visit Mary early in the morning and then go to work so he could cover both her patients and his. He was asked why he didn't have his cell phone next to him that night, and he said that Mary had moved the charging station to another room a few months prior, and since he thought she had a routine GI bug, he wasn't too worried. When he got to the hospital the next day, Mary was much worse. Quote, she was lying in a bed. She like was strapped down to the bed. She had a huge tube down her throat, tubes everywhere. She just looked absolutely terrified. He said he called his kids and said, your mom's really ill, come immediately. He also left a message for Katie at the office saying, Mary's really sick, cancel all patients today. He said at that time, no one had any idea why she had gotten sick so quickly. Bill was asked about his relationship with Kathy, Mary's sister. He said she was just his sister-in-law and that he had only seen her 3 times in the year before Mary's death, each time with Mary. He first saw her on Mother's Day at a barbecue, then again on June 20th, when he and Mary went over to her house to play a board game, and then on June 27th, when they all went to a pottery workshop. In the days following Mary's death, he said he leaned on Kathy for comfort because, quote, she was the only person I knew that had been through what I was going through. He said he wanted to talk to someone who was not just wishing him well, but who actually knew it. He said he asked her at Mary's celebration of life if they could get together and talk about this process, and she said she would be happy to. During the month of August, he said he and Adam spent some time at Leanna's and then flew out to California and then Arizona to be with his side of the family. He didn't work at all in August or September. The chiropractor who was supposed to cover for them in September while they went on their trip covered both months. Katie worked there during those months too. When he found out that colchicine had been found in Mary's body, he went through the entire house shelf by shelf and put all of Mary's supplements and medications into a big box. He then drove that box over to the medical examiner's office. He found out that law enforcement was involved in the case in the beginning of December from one of Mary's patients. He said he told her that they're just reaching out to all of Mary's friends and patients and to just tell them the truth, to cooperate with them. At that point, he had not been contacted by law enforcement yet, which he didn't think was odd. He said he knew he would be their prime suspect. Quote, I was the husband and they would talk to everybody else first before they came to me, and I just thought that they'll get to me when they're ready. He said he trusted them. On December 23rd, they did reach out to him. He went to the Oneida County Sheriff's Office and was interviewed for about 6 hours or so. He signed a waiver so they could collect all the electronics from the office. They then drove over to the office and they took everything they wanted, including the 2 computers, fax machine, and typewriter. He continued to cooperate in the investigation and let investigators take whatever they wanted. He was asked about Adam's known email addresses, and he said Adam had 3 that he would use. Prosecutor Lisi asked if he had known Adam to use MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com, and he said no. He was asked if he had ever used that account, and he said no. He was then shown a message from the office message pad where Katie would log phone calls for them. On January 12th, there was a message to Adam from Art Chemicals. He told the jury he had never heard of Art Chemicals. He was then shown the paperwork that had been sent to Art Chemicals for the colchicine purchase, including the letter of intent and tax forms. He testified that the logo on the paperwork was similar to their company logo, but that it was different. Instead of Chiropractic Family Care, the logo just said Chiro Family Care. The address and fax number were correct, but the phone number was one he didn't recognize. The letter of intent that had been faxed over was signed by Dr. Mary Yoder, but he said that the signature was off, that Mary always signed on the line, and that this one was floating way above the line. There was also a signature for Adam Yoder, indicating that he was the accounts receivable manager for Chiro Family Care. He said Adam never held such a position, and that no one there did. The date on the tax form was dated January 14, 2015, and it was stamped with the stamper he said Katie used in the office. When asked if he thought starting a relationship with Kathy in early September was a little bit too soon, he said, quote, I was 70 years old. I had nothing. It felt like I had nothing at all left in my life. No future. Just felt pain and sadness every day. And I'd learned firsthand that everything could be ripped away in an instant. And I saw this chance for a little companionship and human warmth and just a little bit of happiness. And I thought, you know, I might be gone tomorrow. It was like I didn't want to wait around until everybody thought it was politically correct. While Bill was in California and Arizona visiting family after Mary's death, he said Katie was still working in the office. Before he left, he had pre-signed about 50 checks and told her that if any bills come in, to just open them and pay them. When he got back, he discovered that one entire sheet of the carbon copies for 25 checks was missing. He asked Katie about it, and she said she didn't know anything about it. In the beginning of January 2016, he said he closed down the practice. The computers had all been taken by the sheriff's department, and so they couldn't really work anymore. In March, he started gathering his papers to file his taxes. He saw that a check had been written in the amount of $43.35 to Easy Pass Violations Processing Center. He said he does have an Easy Pass, but that he had never received a violation from it. But it was his signature on the check. It was from one of the prepaid checks he had left for Katie. Another check, numbered right after that, was in the amount of $50 to the Utica City Hall parking violations. Bill said he never got a parking ticket in Utica. It was dated September 15th, and he said he wasn't in the office then. It was another check he had left for Katie. He was then shown a parking ticket, pleading guilty, that had his name signed on it. He said that wasn't his signature and that he was not in Utica on that day. The address was where his son Adam was living at the time. Prosecutor Lisi asked him about inheritance money he had received after his father died. He said his father did leave him a lot of money, money that nobody but Mary knew he had. He and his three siblings had split it. On cross-examination, Bill was pressed about his relationship with Kathy. Christopher Pelley asked if it was true that he used to meet up with her at a hotel in Albany prior to Mary's death, and he said no, never. He was also asked who all had keys to the office in July of 2015. He said he, Mary, Katie, and Adam all did. Pelley then started asking about Adam and asked if Adam had psychological issues. Bill said no, not really. Pelley then brought out text messages that Bill had sent to the prosecutor on August 2, 2016, saying that Adam has a psychological condition. Bill said he was referring to the stress he was under since losing his mother. Pelley read another text from May 16, 2015. Bill had texted Mary, quote, "Love you too. Sorry you had a rough patch last night, and sorry that I did too. Thank God literally that we have each other." Bill said he doesn't remember what the rough patch was in reference to. Pelley told the court that the very last call Mary had made from her cell phone was from around midnight on July 21st while she was at the hospital. She had called their landline. Bill said that's true, but that she didn't leave a message. The second to the last phone call was to his cell phone, which he had earlier testified that he had left in another room. The lead investigator in the case, Mark Van Namme, testified that they didn't start investigating Mary's death until they received a phone call from one of Mary's sisters in October of 2015. Sharon Mills, Mary's youngest sister, called on October 15th and told him that the medical examiner had concluded that colchicine toxicity was the cause of her sister's death. He said he had never heard of that before, but he told her he would contact the medical examiner's office. After speaking with the medical examiner, Investigator Van Namme officially opened an investigation into Mary's death. He became the lead detective. As part of the investigation, he said he looked into whether Mary had a life insurance policy. He checked a database and couldn't find one. He then preserved the cell phone records for both Mary and Bill, and looked into any deliveries that were made to the Yoder business and home. Before they received the anonymous letters, he said Bill was their only person of interest. Investigator Van Namme said he was a person of interest because he was married to the victim, operated a business with her, and he was obviously closely linked with her. After receiving the anonymous letters, Adam then became a person of interest. He said they looked into Adam's background, checked whether he was in town at the time, what vehicle he drove, etc. They even drove by where he lived and took photos of his Jeep. He said once they found the colchicine bottle and invoice in Adam's car, they had new leads to look into. They contacted artchemicals.com, who told them the order had been placed via the Gmail address listed on the invoice. They then got a subpoena for that Gmail account. The information they received back from Google was that the account had been created from an IP address matching that of Chiropractic Family Care. Most logins came back to Chiropractic Family Care, but there was a login on October 9th of 2015 that came back to Vincent Conley, Katie's parents' home, and another login from November 26th, 2015, where the person accessing the account actually deleted it. The IP address for that activity came back to Katie's cell phone. On cross-examination, Investigator Van Namme agreed that prior to Sharon's phone call in October, no one from Mary's family had called about her death, including Bill nor Adam. Regarding the life insurance company database he said he had checked, he agreed that he only checked one, and so he couldn't be sure how comprehensive it was. Adam Yoder took the stand next. He said he and Katie dated for about 2 years after meeting in 2011. They broke up for the first time in 2013. He said 2 months later, Katie wanted to get back together, but he was already seeing somebody else. Then about a month after that, they did get back together after Katie told him she had suffered a miscarriage. In January 2014, he had some credit card and student loan debt. He said Katie offered to pay it off for him as a loan that he could pay back when he was more comfortable. She also loaned him $3,000 a few months later so he could buy his Jeep Wrangler. All in all, he said he owed her $15,000. In August 2014, he said he broke up with her so he could go back to school. He said she wasn't happy about it and she wanted to stay together. He said they tried to resume some type of friendship, but he said it was hard because he still had feelings for her. In April 2015, he said he got very sick with what appeared to be some sort of GI bug. He went to the emergency room and was sick for about 2 weeks. He said he had extreme abdominal pain, extreme back pain, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. In July 2015, he was in between semesters. He said he and Katie didn't talk at all in July. He went to his sister Leanna's house in Long Island to stay with her for his niece's birthday. He was asked if he had ever told Katie that he was going, and he said no. She didn't know about his trip. After learning his mom was going to be admitted to the hospital, he said he decided to drive back that night so he could be with her in the hospital the next day. He left Long Island around 8 p.m. and drove to Oneida County at the house where he had been living with another roommate. He got there around 3 a.m. and went to sleep. He woke up a couple hours later after getting a phone call from his dad about how his mom's condition had gotten worse. He said he threw on his clothes and drove to the hospital as fast as he could. On his way there, he called Katie. He said he was panicking, and Katie was the only female he was close to at the time. He said he reached out for somebody, anybody. When asked to describe his mother when he got there, he started crying and said, quote, "She couldn't speak. She couldn't write anything down. She wanted to communicate. Her hands were swollen. Her arms were swollen." He said he stood next to her and tried to hold her hands. He said he left the hospital twice that day. The first time, he asked Katie if she would give him a ride to Barnes & Noble so he could get some gardening magazines for his mom. He said he was panicking and was just trying to get whatever he could to help her pull through. He said he left the hospital a second time to get a painting he had made his mom for Mother's Day to bring it back to the hospital. It was at his parents' house, and so Katie drove him there to get it. When asked why he did that, he said, quote, "I was desperate. I don't know." He said he told Katie that he didn't know what was going on or how long he would be there so that she didn't have to wait there for him. After she left, she texted him that she was crying in her car. She said his mother wasn't important to just him and that she was upset that she wasn't allowed in there. He said he tried to be sensitive to that, and so he went downstairs to get her and brought her up to his mom's room. After his mom passed away, He left the hospital to go back to his place where he was living, and Katie followed in her car. He said when they got there, he just collapsed on the floor and tried to lay down in his bed a little bit. He said Katie comforted him. His mom's celebration of life was on July 25th. He said that night, he and Katie were intimate, which was the first time in a while they had been together like that. Katie continued to help him with his grief in the next few weeks. In September 2015, he moved in with his cousin David. He and Katie were dating again at that time. He was asked if Katie was there at the house on September 14th, and he said yes. She had spent the night that night, and then the next morning after she left, she text messaged him that she had received a parking ticket. On September 18th, Adam went with his dad and Leanna to New York City to attend a Down syndrome walk. One of Leanna's children has Down syndrome. As he and his dad were driving there, his dad told him what his mom had passed away from, colchicine poisoning. That was the first time he had learned that. He said he tried to assist in gathering any and all supplements his mom was taking. Not long after that, he and Katie were hanging out, and he told her that they had to stop at the office. He drove them there in his Jeep. When they got there, Katie let them in with her key. He said he didn't have his key on him, and that in fact, he didn't even think he still had one. He later found it in storage in his stuff, but at the time, he didn't know that. When they got inside, he told her that he needed to gather up anything his mom could have ingested on that day. He told her that they had found something in his mother's system, but he didn't tell her what it was. When asked what Katie's response was, he said she was very unhelpful gathering anything. He said he was upset and wanted to find answers. He started pointing out things to Katie to collect, and she would tell him that it was stupid and, "Don't look there, don't grab that." When they got to the area by her desk, she said there's no chance that his mom would go over there or take anything from there. He said he got extremely frustrated with her and said, "Look, I can't tell you what's going on yet. I just need help gathering stuff up. I don't care how much of a long shot it is. I want to bring it all over." He said he was so frustrated with her that he decided to leave and just drive her back to school. On December 8th, he got the call from Investigator Van Namme, and so he went into the police station. When they told him about the anonymous letter and showed him the parts that referenced his vehicle, he said he was scared and angry that someone was doing that to him. When asked why he requested to speak with an attorney before consenting to his car being searched, he said he had just been shown the letter, which told him that someone was trying to frame him. He was scared, and he had never been interrogated by the police before, so it seemed like the smartest thing for him to do would be to consult with an attorney. He said when he talked to the public defender, he was asked if there was anything he was hiding in his car, and he said no. So the attorney told him to let them do it. He was watching as the investigator searched his car. They showed him the bottle of colchicine they retrieved from under the passenger seat. He said he had never seen that before and had never put it there, nor did he have any idea that it was there. When they showed him the invoice that was with it, he saw that there was an email address on it that wasn't his, but it looked like a combination of two of his email addresses. The invoice also said the colchicine had been shipped to him at his parents' office. He said he never had anything shipped to his parents' office before. He said the sheriff's office made a request of him that day, and so immediately after the interview, he went to live with his sister Leanna in Long Island. He only returned to Utica whenever he met with investigators. Prosecutor Lisi asked him about an app called Cam Scanner. Adam said he had that app on his phone, that it allows you to take photos of papers and then turn those photos into a PDF so you can send them as documents. He said he used to use that app for school and that he had shown Katie how to use it too. In the fall of 2012, he upgraded his iPhone and bought one for Katie too. He said they shared his Apple ID account, so that when he bought paid apps, she would have access to them on her phone as well. When they broke up in August of 2013, he told her that she couldn't use his Apple ID anymore, and she told him that she had gotten her own. He was asked if he had a password for Cam Scanner, and he said no. He had never made an account on it. He was then asked if he had ever used the password, "Adam is gay," and he said no. On cross-examination, Katie's attorney, Christopher Pelley, asked him if he had an iPhone shipped to Chiropractic Family Care Center in December of 2014, and he said it's possible, but that he doesn't recall. Is it fair to say that you weren't getting a whole lot of help from your parents financially? Pelly asked him, after bringing up his school loans and credit card debt. Yes, Adam replied, but he said he was being an adult and taking his own student loans out. He was then asked, when his grandpa died, if he expected to get some help financially once the estate was settled. He said no. He said he never knew how much his dad received from the estate. His mom told him that they were receiving an inheritance, but he never knew the amount they got. On redirect, he said the rear hatch on his Jeep was unable to be locked, so if he left his Jeep somewhere, anybody could get into it. Margaret Biondo testified that she worked for a company called Enzo Life Science. She said their website sells colchicine, available as a powder, and for research use only. They sell to a lot of educational or academic research facilities and pharmaceutical companies. In order to purchase it, customers must turn in a new customer application and a W-9 form. On December 31st, 2014, she said they received an order through their website. The payment was made with the MasterCard, and the billing address was for Adam Yoder, office manager, materials department of Chiro Family Care, with the billing and shipping address of Chiropractic Family Care. Since the company didn't have an account set up, she said they emailed a new customer application and a W-9 form to the email provided later that day. The two-page application is mandatory and must list two business references along with a bank reference. She said they never heard back, and so the order was never processed. Michael Capetta works for a company called Spectrum Manufacturing, which sells colchicine in powder form. He said all customers must have an account set up with them in order to purchase from them. They only sell to companies and not individuals. He said if a company wishes to purchase colchicine, they must submit a letter of intended use, which basically states what they're using it for. They have two types of customers: lab customers who use it for research, and pharmacy customers who use it for treatment of gout. He identified a company called Copper Harbor, who's a reseller of theirs. They have their own account and have the ability to resell like a distributor. On January 7th, 2015, Copper Harbor ordered 1 gram of colchicine. Under the intended use portion of the order form, they had entered that it was for Chiro Family Care. The intended use was entered as, quote, used to encourage polyhaploidism in plants to study specific gene expressions. The order was shipped to Copper Harbor on January 16, 2015. Rosa Vargas testified that she was a sales rep at Copper Harbor, also known as Art Chemicals. On January 5, 2015, at 2:21 p.m., she received an order for 1 gram of colchicine. The order was to be delivered to Adam Yoder at Chiro Family Care. She double-checked the pricing with the manufacturer and found that the pricing had actually gone up, so she wanted to contact the customer to see if they still wanted to purchase it. She first called the number they had listed on the order, but wasn't able to get through. So she Googled the business and found a different number from their website, and so she called there. She spoke to a female, whose voice, she said, was soft and sounded young. The female agreed to pay the higher price. Rosa processed their payment via PayPal, but when she placed the order from the manufacturer, she was told they needed the business license and purpose of use for the item ordered. She then contacted the Gmail address to let them know what was required. She also contacted that same phone number as she did before. She again spoke to the same female and told her what was needed. She didn't hear back, and so she sent another email requesting the documents. A few days later, on January 12th, she received a response from that email address. The email included the business tax ID number, the New York State license number, and a letter of intent, which essentially stated that they would be using it for plant research. There was no signature on the letter of intent, so she asked them to scan it and email it back to her. 2 days later, she received a response. Here you go, Rosa. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for all of your help. Adam. The signatures in the letter of intent were Adam Yoder, accounts receivable manager, and Dr. Mary Yoder. At the bottom of the letter of intent, it said, "Scanned by CAM scanner." Thomas Johnson, manager of the subpoena processing unit at U.S. Bank, gave the jury details about two prepaid debit cards that were used in the Colchicine orders. When the first card was registered, it was registered under the name Adam Yoder, and the email was MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com. $150 was loaded onto that card on December 22, 2014, at a grocery store in New Hartford, New York. No full purchases went through on the card, but there was activity. There was a total of 6 authorizations, 3 of them on December 31, 2014, with a company called EntroPay, and 2 others to Enzo Life Sciences. Yet another was on January 5th to PayPal. There was a second card that was purchased with the same account details as the other one. $200 was loaded onto this one on January 5th, 2015, also at the grocery store in New Hartford, New York. This card was used on January 7th for Copper Harbor in the amount of $189.22. Amy Nesselrode, a forensic scientist specializing in DNA analysis, testified that she tested the Colchicine bottle found in Adam's car. The vial itself had a mixture of at least 3 contributors, and Caitlin Conley could not be excluded as the donor of the major contributor. She said it's at least 1.2 quadrillion times more likely if it originated from Katie than from 3 unknown, unrelated individuals. Quote, "This analysis provides support that Caitlin Conley is a contributor to the DNA profile obtained from the vial." She also compared the DNA profiles from Bill and Adam to the evidence profile from the vial. Adam was excluded as a possible contributor, and no conclusion could be determined as to whether Bill was a contributor. It was inconclusive. Cheryl Moorhead, a forensic scientist with the New York State Police, tested the cardboard container the vial came in. She said there was a mixture profile of at least 2 donors, but there was a major contributor on the outside which matched Katie. She said there was no male DNA detected. As for the invoice that was found with the container, she said there wasn't enough DNA on it to make a comparison. Lieutenant Robert Nelson testified that after they found the items in Adam's vehicle, he asked Adam to immediately leave the area. He suggested Adam go stay with Leanna in Long Island and to leave as soon as he could, and so later that day, Adam left town to stay with Leanna, as instructed. Anthony Martino, a senior forensic examiner, testified that there was no evidence that Katie's phone could be remotely controlled or remotely accessed in any way. Nicholas Gilberti then took the stand and testified that he conducted the forensic examinations on all of the electronics in the case. He said he found nothing of evidentiary value from any of the computers taken from the Conley residence, on any of the devices belonging to Adam, or on the computer from the back office at Chiropractic Family Care. But on the computer taken from the reception area, he found web searches related to Colchicine, all from April 27, 2015, before Mary's death. One article was titled, "Cardiotoxic Changes of Colchicine Intoxication in Rats." Another was, "What is Colchicine?" And another, "Diagnosis and Treatment of Colchicine Poisoning." Gilberti said he also found that whoever had been using that computer had used a private browser to log into the Mr. Adam Yoder 1990 Gmail account and had also viewed artchemicals.com on a private browser too. He was also able to detect other activity on that computer that was relevant to the case. The user searched to see if the domain Cairo Family Care was available, and the anonymous letters that were sent to the sheriff's office and the medical examiner had been edited in the browser as well. Gilberti testified that he found no evidence that any remote connections were made. There was no other way for that information to appear on that computer other than it happened on the computer, he said. Gilberti also examined Katie's iPhone. When he did a search for Colchicine, he said it turned up in the user dictionary, which keeps track of words that the user has typed. That's how it can provide autocorrect suggestions. He said Katie's user dictionary reported that the word had been typed 3 separate times. There was a note in Katie's phone that was created on November 1st, 2015 at 7:21 p.m. This was 4 months after Mary's death. The note read, quote, A.Y.K., his mother. He put something called colchicine in one of her vitamins when he was at her house for Father's Day. He was upset thinking. He said throughout the analysis of Katie's phone, he recognized that some of the content that appeared in the Notes app also appears in messages, which indicated that the user was preparing the message in Notes and then copying and pasting it into messages, or vice versa. In a note created on November 16, 2015, at 11:26 p.m., someone wrote, "Saw last week. Personal knowledge. Please, please, there is urgency. Small brown vial, under seat. May be moved and disposed of easily. Personally heard and told to me. Don't say drunk. A first-hand and personal account. Self-registered vehicle. I hope these facts are sufficient to constitute cause of action at hospital." Gilberti said he also found some deleted text messages that were relevant to the case. One read, quote, "Your dad said a toxin was found in blood results. Can you tell me more? Adam alluded to it, but then he switched, swore at me, explained how easily replaceable I am, and said I was suspect, so I'm not sure how much I should talk to him. Is foul play suspected? Does the medical examiner think it's from the office? If you have any questions about Monday/office, please let me know." When Gilberti searched the phone for Mr. Adam Yoder, he said MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com came up as the username for Cam Scanner, and the associated password was Adam is gay. He said he couldn't be sure that this app was shared with another phone, but it was inputted on this phone. At the time of his examination of the phone, the Cam Scanner app was no longer on it. Gilberti said he also found 5 emails sent from kaconley@utica.edu, which is the account tied to the device, to MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com. The dates on those emails were all January 14th, 2015, and all were sent within 2 minutes of each other. Prosecutor Lisi pointed out that with the Cam Scanner app, you can scan papers and then share them via email, implying that Katie could have been sending the papers she scanned to the Gmail account so she could forward those on and then place the order for colchicine. Gilberti replied that he manually checked the device and was able to identify that that's exactly what had happened. The PDFs from Cam Scanner were then emailed to the Gmail account. Afterwards, Gilberti said he checked Adam's phone to see if Cam Scanner had ever been logged in with that same login and password as the one on Katie's phone, and he didn't see any indication that it had. Another note from Katie's phone listed the employer identification number for chiropractic family care. Gilberti then moved on to Bill's devices. He said he had an issue with the hard drive from Bill's laptop. He couldn't conduct a full forensic image, which could be due to a number of reasons, including if it had ever been dropped on the floor. He was able to create a partial image of the hard drive. Nothing of evidentiary value was found on either that nor on Bill's laptop. He was able to get a full extraction from Bill's iPhone, and on there, he found 3 text messages between Bill and Kathy from prior to Mary's passing. They were all from the same day, May 12, 2015, around 9:40 p.m. Bill had sent her a link for some grilling gear. To sum up Gilberti's testimony, Prosecutor Lisi asked, "Throughout your entire forensic analysis, can you tell me on how many devices did you find any activity of MrAdamYoder1990@gmail.com? 2 devices, Gilberti replied, Caitlin Conley's iPhone and the front office computer. On cross-examination, Katie's attorney pointed out that there are other programs and other ways to remote into a computer, and Gilberti agreed. After Gilberti's testimony, the state then rested their case. The defense's first witness was a woman named Holly Hiltz. Holly testified that she had an appointment with Mary on July 20th around 10 a.m. She said, contrary to what the state's witnesses said, Mary did not seem normal. She said her energy level was lower and she had redness in her eyes, kind of like when you get a fever or you get ill. Holly also testified that another time she came in, she remembers seeing Bill working at the front reception desk. Tamarin Yoder, Mary and Bill's other daughter and sister to Leanna and Adam, was also called to the stand by the defense. She was asked about a conversation she had with her dad in September of 2015 about his inheritance. Did he tell you that this money would finally allow him to retire because there wasn't two people to support anymore? Katie's attorney, Christopher Pelley, asked. She said he told them that he would be okay retiring at this point. Pelley pointed out that in her statement to police, she had said that her dad made reference about not having to support two people anymore. She said he mentioned that the inheritance might not have been enough for two people. David Yoder, one of Mary's nephews, testified that Adam lived with him from August of 2015 through December 8, 2015. After Adam abruptly went to live with his sister, Leanna, in Long Island, he moved Adam's stuff he had left behind into storage. That following July, he contacted Katie's attorney's office. They went to the storage unit together, and among Adam's things were multiple bottles of supplements and a document that listed IP addresses and websites, including two remote desktop control applications. Janice King, Mary's younger sister, was asked to describe Bill's demeanor at the celebration of life ceremony. She said they hugged and he told her, "She loved you so much." But then the rest of the day, she said he seemed distant. In January or February of 2016, she said she went to the Oneida County Sheriff's Office for a briefing they had on a theory of what had happened to Mary. They showed her certain evidence, and afterwards, she said she spoke to Lieutenant Nelson and told him that she's willing to accept that maybe Katie had something to do with it, but that she could not believe she acted on her own. She told the court that she made it obvious that she didn't agree with their theory. She said she thought that their presentation was going to help her understand why Katie may have done this, but that they didn't do that, that it was just computer logistical stuff. She said, quote, "Couldn't someone have hacked or gotten into the computer stuff or the phone stuff?" She said it was like they didn't want to hear anything she had to say about it. One of Kathy's neighbors, Patricia Keating, testified that she had seen Bill and Kathy together prior to Mary's death. She said that sometime during the week of July 12, 2015, she had gone on a walk with her daughter when she came up to Kathy's house. She saw Bill and Kathy on the porch. She said she was about to wave and say hello, but she felt uncomfortable, quote, "because they were together and it was pretty intense." She said she told her daughter, "don't look," and they just walked by. When asked to describe what Bill and Kathy were doing, she said they were sitting on the ground on the porch and Bill was holding Kathy and he was kissing her and looking into her eyes and it was very intense. She said she's positive that it was July 2015 because she was talking to her daughter, who was having serious medical problems, about seeing a new doctor that following week. She was shown a photo of Bill's car and she was asked if she had seen that car prior to July 2015 and she said yes. Every morning she would walk with a neighbor friend, and there were certain mornings they would walk by and the car would be there. She said she also recalled seeing Bill at Kathy's house on two or three separate occasions prior to July 2015. She said she saw Kathy and Bill doing yard work together one of the times. She said she formally met Bill in December of 2015 at a Christmas party in the neighborhood. Sharon Mills, another one of Mary's sisters, testified that she was the one who initially called the police in October 2015 after learning about how Mary had died. She said as the investigation progressed, she kept in contact with Lieutenant Nelson. At one point, she went into the station and told them about some alternate theory she had, but they only seemed interested in hearing about Bill. She said she told them, quote, "if he did it, you're never going to catch him." When asked why she would say that, she said she believes him to be brilliant. She said she didn't know Katie, but knew of her. She said her mother always spoke highly of her. Katie decided not to testify, and the defense rested their case. But after more than 4 days of jury deliberations, the jury announced that they were deadlocked. 4 of them wanted to convict her, but 8 of them wanted to acquit. A mistrial was declared. 5 months later, Katie stood trial for the second time, not only with a new defense attorney, but with a new defense theory, too. Instead of pointing the finger at Bill Yoder, in this trial, they said Adam was likely the killer. Katie's new attorney, Frank Policelli, told the jurors that Adam slipped the colchicine into his mother's pills and then framed Katie for it. He said Adam was abusive and controlling to Katie, and that he had access to all of Katie's electronics, making it easy to frame her. He also told the jury about Katie's accusation against Adam, that he raped her back in July of 2014. As you'll recall, she filed a police report months later, and then a few weeks after that, decided not to press charges. During Adam's testimony, he told the jury more about his illness back in April of 2015, just months before his mom's death. He said Katie had given him supplements that she said would help him focus and boost his memory, and that after taking them, he got sick, with nearly identical symptoms as his mom had months later. He said he and Katie were just friends at the time and would try to meet up once a week. After he got sick, he joked with her and asked if she had poisoned him. She told him no, that she would never hurt him. On cross-examination, Adam said he may have set up the wireless internet at Katie's parents' house back in 2013, but he denied ever hacking into it or ever hacking into Katie's cell phone. This time, the jury was unanimous. They found Katie guilty, though not guilty of second-degree murder, guilty of first-degree manslaughter, a choice they didn't have during the first trial. At Katie's sentencing, Adam had some choice words for her.
Make no mistake, I hate the defendant with every bone in my body and every drop of blood in my veins. I hate Caitlin Ann Conley because Caitlin Ann Conley murdered my mother. As far as any of us can guess, she did so to cause me maximum pain and to devastate me completely and permanently. And she did exactly that. In truth, part of the reason I didn't want to make a statement today is because I didn't want to give her that satisfaction. But make no mistake, as much as I hate her, which is more than I ever thought I would be capable of hating anyone, I hate myself infinitely more. I introduced her to my family. I got her a job with my parents. And if I hadn't done those things, my mother would still be alive. And I live with that pain and the torture of that truth. There hasn't been a single day since the first trial where I haven't suffered from that. And I promise every person in this courtroom that I will carry that with me for the rest of my life.
Katie also spoke to the judge before he handed down her sentence.
With all due respect to the justice system, and to our jury system, I'm innocent. I would like to thank my family and friends and strangers for standing up in support of me. That is all, thank you.
The judge then spoke.
It is obvious to everyone in this courtroom how much pain and suffering, both on the victim's family and on the defendant's family. It is not a pleasant day for anyone, and that includes me. I've received dozens of letters on behalf of Mary Yoder. I've received dozens of letters on behalf of Caitlin Conley. And I've considered each and every one of them. The thing that stands out in my mind most of all is those last 2 days of Mary Yoder's life. 2 days may not seem like an awful long time, but if you have a ventilator down your throat and your arms and legs are strapped to the bed, they are an excruciating long time. She went through agony over and over until the end. The doctors had to bring her back 6 or 7 times so that she could continue to endure the pain and the suffering that had gone on for those 2 days. I am also aware of the fact that the evidence presented at the trial indicates that Ms. Connolly was the only person at that time that knew why this was happening and how her life was going to end. The court feels that justice for this agony and torture of this innocent victim deserves a severe punishment.
He then sentenced her to serve 23 years in prison. Katie is appealing the verdict. And meanwhile, Mary's family seems to be split. At least 2 of Mary's sisters have been vocal that they do not agree with the verdict, and that instead, they think either Adam or Bill are the real killers. And that's all for this episode. I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the second jury's verdict? What would you have decided if you were a juror in this case? Let me know by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com, by tweeting me @courtjunkiepod, or telling me on Instagram @courtjunkie. As always, if you'd like to hear these episodes early and ad-free, please consider going to courtjunkie.com/support, where you can get access to early ad-free episodes. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.